Mr. Chairman, members of the board, and advisory team. Okay, this is not. Sorry, I'm having microphone difficulties here. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, and prosecution team. I'm Mona Doherty, an engineer with your staff, and I'm here to discuss the Confusion Hill Bypass Project, ACLC number R1-2009-0095. This is an aerial photo of the project located in Mendocino County that constructed two new bridges. Sorry. Here they are. Constructed two new bridges to replace a section of old roadway, which is located there. The bridges cross the South Fork Eel River, which is impaired for sediment and temperature, provides drinking water and habitat for endangered species. And the river kind of traces out throughout the picture. Lot to do with my hands right now, so I'm trying to do it smoothly. Here we go. Here is another aerial photo of the project, including isolated Pool B that I'll be discussing more. I want to discuss the permits that are applicable to the Confusion Hill Bypass Project today. The first is the Caltrans Stormwater Permit, which is a statewide permit. Oh, sorry. I'm doing so many things. Is there a way we can fix this? It's hard to hold it while I'm doing everything else. There we go. Thank you. Much better. Okay. So this is a statewide permit adopted in 1999. It provides coverage for all Caltrans projects and activities statewide. It requires the use of best management practices to control discharges to waters of the U.S. It provides a regulatory floor, a bare minimum requirements for all projects. Caltrans staff has extensive experience on many projects complying with its stormwater permit. Caltrans applied for a 401 water quality certification for the Confusion Hill project. This is a project-specific permit that allows limited discharges identified in the application to waters of the U.S. The authorized discharges require BMPs to protect water quality, and the 401 is specifically tailored to water bodies and water quality impairments. The 401 prohibits all other discharges. Caltrans proposed BMPs in the application and had input on the 401 conditions. They even received two 401 amendments when they requested them. Regional board staff has the duty and responsibility to ensure compliance with both the stormwater permit and the 401. The stormwater permit requires the robust use of best management practices. BMPs are structural controls or practices that effectively eliminate or minimize the discharge of pollutants. Pollution controls need to be properly selected for the site, activity, and pollutant of concern, properly installed and adequately maintained to be considered BMPs. Efficacy is the most important element of a BMP. For example, scheduling earthwork for the dry season and limiting vegetation removal are some of the most effective BMPs to control the discharge of sediment. Cost. The cost of a particular BMP may not be a good indication of its adequacy. Controls that are improperly selected, installed, or maintained may be both inadequate and quite expensive. Staff reviews BMPs proposed in permit applications and used in the field for their adequacy. Many of the discharges and permit violations at Confusion Hill would have been avoided with the use of common, cost-effective, industry-accepted BMPs. And in fact, Caltrans uses effective BMPs on many projects. Many activities at Confusion Hill were conducted without adequate BMPs, and in some cases without BMPs at all. The Caltrans Construction BMP Manual was developed to comply with a stormwater permit for use on all construction projects throughout the state. It includes bare minimum BMPs to be used for project activities, and it also acknowledges that additional BMPs may be needed to protect water quality in sensitive waters or for additional construction activities. The 401 permit process works hand-in-hand with the stormwater permit and provides many opportunities to seek clarification if needed. During the permitting process, we consider and discuss with the applicant the site constraints, sensitive water issues, appropriate BMPs, and the regional board's expectations for compliance. This is the 401 and pre-construction process followed with this project. There were opportunities throughout for Caltrans and their contractor, MCM, to seek clarification if they did not understand permit conditions or thought that it would be impossible to comply. And in fact, regional board staff attended a pre-construction meeting with Caltrans and MCM and issued two 401 amendments at Caltrans' request. Project communication is an important tool for permit compliance, and there were many opportunities to engage in this project. The project is littered with instances of poor communication on permit compliance and discharges that contributed to many violations. Permittees cannot unilaterally alter or ignore permit conditions for convenience or cost savings. The optimal time to seek clarification of permit conditions is before project activities and during the project as needed, not retroactively during enforcement proceedings. Staff inspected early in the project, and we issued two notices of violation and a water code 13267 order to enforce permit compliance. This did not result in the desired deterrent effect, and unfortunately, compliance did not improve. Staff had no choice but to issue the ACLC. After extensive, time-consuming efforts to resolve this matter, settlement discussions failed, and staff had to proceed to hearing. Inadequate project communication played a pivotal role in many of the violations that we're discussing today. I'd like to illustrate a few examples. Caltrans applied to construct a temporary sedimentation basin set back at least 100 feet from the active channel of the river for dewatering purposes. A sedimentation basin is used to trap and remove sediment with a lining or filter fabric before water is discharged to waters of the U.S. Throughout the record on this matter, Caltrans refers to isolated pool B for dewatering. Isolated pool is not a sedimentation basin, but is waters of the U.S. Even though Caltrans did not have a permit to discharge sediment-laden water, concrete wastewater, rock, or even construction dewatering flows to this pool, these discharges occurred during this project. Isolated pool B is separated from the South Fork Eel River active channel during the dry season low flow period only and is hydrologically connected at all times. It's not really an isolated pool at all, but is part of the river, waters of the U.S., and has beneficial uses of its own to protect. The biological monitoring reports for this project include several references to isolated pool B containing frogs, spawn, and fish that were both killed and displaced during unauthorized discharges of rock and pollutants to isolated pool B. Fish and Game staff informed me that the isolated pool B provided habitat for threatened amphibians and that habitat was damaged by unauthorized discharges. Isolated pool B is waters of the U.S. because it is below the line of ordinary high water that the United States Army Corps of Engineers uses to delineate waters of the United States. This schematic of the Army Corps of Engineers regulatory jurisdiction shows the line of ordinary high water, which is right here, in rivers and streams that delineates waters of the U.S. under the Clean Water Act. We've added an illustration of the dry season low flow active channel of the South Fork Eel River and the relationship to isolated pool B. Both the blue dot that represents the dry season low flow active channel of the river, right there, and the yellow dot that represents isolated pool B are below the line of ordinary high water and therefore both are waters of the U.S. Discharges are not allowed to just find a pool of waters of the U.S., discharge waste to it, and call it a sedimentation basin. Another illustration of project violations occurred when turbidity plumes were not appropriately monitored and reported. The industry standard for turbidity monitoring is lab testing or field monitoring equipment with equivalent accuracy, and the units of measurements are NTUs. These are the scientifically based methods that provide adequate, reliable, and accurate data to determine compliance with the basin plan as required in the 401. Visual observations can be used as a trigger for the need for turbidity monitoring, but are completely inadequate to verify compliance with the basin plan. Condition 19 of the 401 water quality certification specifies visual observations to determine when field turbidity measurements should be taken. Condition 19 draws a clear distinction between visual observations and field turbidity measurements. Failure to conduct monitoring and report to the regional boards robs staff of the ability to assess project compliance and impacts to water quality. Caltrans and MCM consistently failed to monitor turbidity and report as required by the 401 water quality certification. Now I'd like to turn the presentation over to Case and Grady to discuss specific violations. Okay.
Pardon me to interrupt briefly. Are cross-examinations going to be done as part of our case in chief, or are we going to be able to do those immediately? Our preference would be to do it immediately.
Well, I thought we were going to go through the presentation. They would call their witnesses, and then we would do it after those. And that's what I thought we agreed to that during our pre-hearing call. That was my understanding.
That's right, and that's what you're asking. So he's going to finish his presentation, and that will be the staff's case in chief, and then you can question either witness.
Okay. That's fine.
Okay. Thanks.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the board. I'm Casey Grady, Water Resources Control Engineer, staff to the board. Here's a slide reiterating the enforcement chronology. It's been touched on a few times, so I think I will just move over it. I would, since I was the primary staff developer of the complaint, I will review with the board the prosecution team's process used to develop it. But before I begin, I'd like to first summarize some of the documents you should have in. Maybe not with you right now, but for your review, which include the administrative civil liability complaint that we're discussing today, as well as a binder of documentary evidence that has been produced, a large chart to clarify some of the penalties in the complaint, as well as another binder of photographic evidence. Due to the repetitive number and nature of violations, staff organized the violations by discharge type into these seven categories, A through H. Now that I've described the categories, I'm going to review some evidence from September 29, 2006, to show the board how staff determined violations and assessed penalties. On the top of this slide is a summary of some documents of some of the evidence that we relied upon underlying violation numbers 73 and 75. These documents appear full size in later slides, as you can see on this slide. Evidence that supports these two violations includes photographs and citations to documents created by Caltrans personnel and biological monitors on site. I will begin reviewing the evidence from September 29, 2006 by showing you some photographs taken by the biological monitor. This photograph shows two footings in the Eel River that were constructed to support the false work for the North Bridge construction. This photo shows the two footings immediately after contractors just poured cement into these corrugated metal pipe forms with inadequate containment BMPs. I will now go back in time about an hour and a half to show you the discharges and violations resulting from this activity. This photograph at 4:03 p.m., September 29, 2006, shows a hopper full of cement being lowered by a crane for workers to pour into these two corrugated metal pipes to create footings for the trestle deck. At 4:05, the cement pour began discharging through the bottom of the forms, as can be seen by the dark plume here at the bottom of the corrugated metal pipe. At 406, you can see the plume extending downriver. And I will now click through some of these photos more quickly to show you the movement of the plume through time. Here, 2 minutes after the pour started, the contractors continue to pour without modification to BMPs. And the plume continues. This photo is a picture looking further downstream, showing the plume. And now I'm going to go back to, this is just a minute after the first pour started at 406, showing the edge of the active channel. Here's at the end of that minute, and 2 minutes later, the turbidity has increased so you cannot even see through less than a foot of water. 410, the plume continues downstream. 422, the plume is still there. And at about 430, the contractors switched to the next footing and began a second pour sometime about 440. This next slide shows at 512, there's still a plume in the river. 512, another angle of the cementitious turbid discharge. And at 512, I like this photo because it shows the thickness and the contrast in turbidity in this plume very clearly. That indicates that a new discharge occurred from the second footing, that this was not from the first footing seal pour. And I will note that this does not look like algae to me. Now, leaving the photographic evidence, this slide shows a quote from Caltrans engineer's report from September 29th, and the relevant excerpt in reference to footing number 3 states concrete escaped the footing, leading to a turbidity plume approximately 150 feet in length. Further down in this same Caltrans engineer's daily report, another excerpt refers to a discharge from footing number 4. It says, during placement of the number 4 footing, the contractor tremie on the hopper came off. While trying to reattach the tremie, the contractor worked around the corrugated metal pipe standing on the sandbags. A plume was evident, but how much was concrete or how much was algae was hard to determine. This is a page from a Caltrans 13267 response. We have highlighted two quotes where Caltrans admits a discharge of water that may have come into contact with wet cement on this date, and another quote indicating the creation of a turbidity plume. Here is a table from the final biological monitor's report, also known as the URS report, confirming the 150-foot plume right here that lasted for 82 minutes from a cement footing seal pour. The table also shows that visual observations confirmed an increase in turbidity, on their fabricated scale, which is a visual scale of 3. The table also shows that no field turbidity measurements were taken at all in the turbidity NTU column. It says NA for not applicable. And the board has no other evidence that turbidity measurements were taken on this. Let me go back. So this proves to the prosecution team a violation of condition 9 of the water quality certification occurred. Let's review condition 9, which says no debris, soil, cement or concrete washings, or other organic earth material from any construction associated activity of whatever nature shall be allowed to enter into or be placed where it may be washed by rainfall into waters of the state. This is a direct discharge of cementitious material to waters of the state. After reviewing the evidence, determining a violation, the next step in the process that we followed for every violation and category was to consider Water Code 13385 factors. that serve to determine the appropriate liability in relation to the maximum. For this example of a violation of Condition 9, I will point out the nature of the discharge, the degree of toxicity of materials, and the receiving water. There was a sediment discharge to a sediment-impaired water body. There were insufficient BMPs to prevent the discharge, and the contractor continued its activities without modifying its BMPs. However, the discharge was preventable, and there are industry-standard BMPs in Caltrans' own BMP manual to prevent such discharges. In this instance, there were two discharges and no actions taken to remedy it, and no factors suggested to the prosecution team a significant reduction in the recommended penalty. There were a total of 20 turbid discharge violations, not all of which included cementitious wastes, as in this example. Staff conservatively recommends a minor reduction from the maximum potential penalty from $10,000 per violation to $7,500 for each violation in this category. The total maximum potential liability for this category is $200,000, while staff recommends $150,000. This slide summarizes the process necessary to get a fair recommendation. We reviewed the evidence, consulted the permits, and considered the factors to suggest a penalty for each violation and category in the complaint. I'll now go over another category in the complaint, and we followed the same process for each. Here, for insufficient turbidity measurements, I will now point your attention to some evidence from October 7th, 2007, which is referred to as violation ID in this large chart and the documentary binder that we provided. These photos show an increase in turbidity above background that would have triggered the need for field turbidity measurements, but none were taken. Here is a larger version of the photographic evidence taken by the biological monitor, showing a large turbidity plume and insufficient BMPs for the containment of sediment. This is another photo showing the flow of the turbidity plume downstream. This piece of evidence is an admission by Caltrans that a plume was noted during an attempt to install the remaining two footings for the false work trestle, and no turbidity measurements are available. Since Condition 19 requires field turbidity measurements to be collected whenever a project activity causes turbidity to be increased above background, as observed with visual observations, but since no turbidity measurements were taken, this is a clear violation of Condition 19. The lack of quality turbidity measurements is inextricably linked to cost savings due to the man-hour savings of not employing one or more people to calibrate, maintain, and operate turbidity measuring equipment, as well as the time savings from the potential delays and additional BMPs that would result from measuring an increased turbidity of greater than 20% at 100 feet downstream. The lack of quality field turbidity measurements undercuts the Regional Water Board's ability to review the project for compliance with the Basin Plan, water quality turbidity objective, and with the water quality certification. However, these violations are monitoring and reporting violations as opposed to the discharge themselves. And there were some attempts to taking turbidity measurements on this project. A reduction from the maximum is recommended from $10,000 per violation to $5,000 per violation. There were a total of 22 insufficient turbidity measurement violations proposed in the complaint, with a maximum total liability of $220,000 with a recommendation of $110,000. Moving on to another category in the complaint, improper disposal of cement wastes. This is one of the most egregious categories, so I'm reviewing several pieces of evidence that underlie several different violations. Here is the response to the 13267 order from Caltrans, and it says, on August 29th, during placing a concrete and a corrugated steel pipe within the river, the water level rose, and to prevent it from overflowing into the river, the water was pumped to the dewatering basin. After placing the concrete seal course, the contractor cleaned the hopper, trimming, and shovels in a footing excavation in the river bar. For another two violations, we have some photos and another document which corroborate each other. This photo depicts a corrugated metal pipe with cement and a white PVC pipe here connected to discharge into isolated pool B on this date. This piece of evidence says it's from you read the quote. It says, the water was tested for pH, treated with muriatic acid, and then pumped into the settlement basin. I estimate that about 25 gallons was pumped from the left concrete seal pour and perhaps 50 gallons from the right. This is a document from an excerpt from the URS report. It shows a picture here that I'll show in the next slide, and the caption says cement waste pour to the edge of isolated pool B. Here, cement was apparently just discharged directly to the gravel bar, which is the waters of the state, and is between isolated pool B and the river, or the active channel. The evidence I've described summarize how it demonstrates to the prosecution team that there was violations of Condition 9 and 17 for this category. Condition 9 prohibits the discharge of cement or concrete washings to waters of the state or to areas where it may be washed by rainfall in the waters of the state as well. Condition 17 requires that all activities, best management practices, shall be conducted as described in this permit, as well as the application submitted by the applicant on this project. Water Board staff denied the original application from Caltrans for the water quality certification on this project to ensure that Caltrans understood the requirement of full containment of cementitious wastes, and this is included as part of the application. Furthermore, the activities described that resulted in violations of Condition 9 were the result of lack of BMPs. These two conditions are distinct because Condition 9 prohibits the discharge to waters of the state, while 17 requires the use of BMPs and implementation of the project as described. In reviewing the 13-85 factors for the cementitious waste discharge category, we reviewed the high toxicity of discharge because cement wastes are sediment discharges to a sediment-impaired water body, as well as the high pH of cementitious wastewaters. There's a very high culpability by the discharger based on the very clear control practices that were taken. They discharged, they were dealing with a controlled waste product, as well as it was very clear that it was prohibited to discharge. And there was an economic benefit by avoiding the costs to adequately contain and dispose of the cementitious wastewater. For this category, there were 16 violations in the complaint for a maximum of $160,000, and we found no reason to reduce the maximum potential recommendation. For the leaky equipment category, that's a category that staff created in developing the complaint to organize the violations. Perhaps this category could be better titled petroleum product discharges, but I will refer to leaky equipment because that's the category name in the complaint. To further summarize the process of evidentiary review taken by staff and how the types of evidence used for this category, I will go over violation IDs 109 and 110. We have these three photographs from the biological monitoring reports showing three distinct events. Staff, and we have a quote from the biological monitor, and we feel that the photos corroborate the quote sufficiently to determine that a discharge and a threatened discharge to waters of the state occurred on October 12th. 2006. This photo depicts a discharge of oil from a crane onto the trestle deck above the river. There are multiple oil stains in the foreground and what appears to be some absorbent material used to mitigate the discharge of oil onto the trestle deck and the threatened discharge of oil to the river. This photograph was titled IR Leaker by the Biological Monitor and shows a compressor on the gravel bar with plastic sheeting strewn beneath. The plastic sheeting is not bermed in a manner to sufficiently contain leaks from the compressor, and it appears to be discharging its contents onto the gravel bar by the staining there. This photograph was labeled by the biological monitor as oil change, and doesn't necessarily depict leaky equipment as the category would suggest, but staff thought that this discharge was most appropriately fit within this category. This photograph convinced staff that MCM did not use adequate BMPs while performing an oil change, and this resulted in a discharge of oil to the ground. Staff have no evidence that this was actually cleaned up, but even if it was, the threatened discharge to waters of the state should have been avoided by the use of BMPs rather than mitigation and cleanup. Condition 9 states that no oil or petroleum products shall be allowed to enter into or be placed where it may be washed by rainfall in the waters of the state. Whereas 13 reiterates the prohibition of Condition 9 and goes further to prohibit the use of any leaky equipment, vehicle, or equipment of any substance that may impact water quality. These three photographs corroborate the quote from the biological monitor that describes a discharge and threatened discharge to waters of the state in violation of Condition 9 and the use of leaky equipment in violation of Condition 13. Let me go here. It is important to note that the category leaky equipment was dealt with in a different manner than some of the other categories, because multiple pieces of evidence of multiple violations on the same day were grouped together to support the assessment of one violation. Using this grouping method, there were still 28 days identified in the complaint of petroleum discharges and or threatened discharges. This process of grouping was the prosecution team's method of conservatively determining violations, which effectively lowered the maximum potential penalty. There were, however, numerous discharges that were preventable. In some instances, there would have been no additional cost to install the BMPs properly, as seen. There is a potential economic benefit by not replacing the chronically leaky equipment as required by the permit. There was, however, evidence of occasional attempts of cleanup, and that was considered as a mitigating factor. There were 28 days of grouped violations in the complaint for a maximum of $280,000 with a total recommended penalty of $150,000. Slag is another category that represents a common type of discharge resulting from welding and steel cutting activities. I have selected violation ID 116 from October 17, 2006 to exemplify the type of discharge supporting these types of violations. Evidence in the record includes many photographs taken by the biological monitor and a quote from the Caltrans engineering report. This photo shows an overview of the construction activities on the gravel bar at the North Bridge work area, which is just one portion of the large project. Upon close analysis, this photo shows two workers actively welding and or steel cutting within waters of the state without adequate containment. Here and here. This photograph shows in more detail a worker welding without adequate containment. This photograph also depicts black staining on the bedrock and gravel bar here, here, and here. This is a closer-up photograph of the residual welding slag or steel cutting wastes within waters of the state and discoloring the waters. This photograph from the same date shows another employee welding within feet of the active river channel during critical low flow conditions and within waters of the state without any containment. This is a zoom in of that last photo, and it shows no containment. Here's another photo on the same day. No containment, direct discharge to waters of the state. This quote from a Caltrans engineering report describes found a welder attaching angles to the cofferdam template with no attempt to catch splatter or slag. I told them they were not allowed to drop material into the water, and they hung a bucket under the work which caught about half of the falling material. This evidence proves to the prosecution team that a violation of Condition 9 occurred. Slag discharges were grouped in a similar manner as the leaky equipment discharges. Due to the number of discharges per day, for example, all of the discharges that we just reviewed were grouped together to support a maximum potential penalty of $10,000 for that day, as opposed to $10,000 for each incident. This was a very conservative stance by the prosecution team and significantly reduced the maximum potential penalty for this category. Well, I don't know which way I'm going. Oh, I'm going forward. Okay.
On your place?
I think so. I'm just ahead of here. There were discharges directly to waters of the state in this example, and other threatened discharges to waters of the state. They would have been easily avoidable with proper containment. There were, however, small total volumes of discharge material. And throughout the project, there were some occasional efforts made to contain the slag with buckets and fire-retardant blankets with moderate success. There were 15 days of grouped slag discharge violations for total maximum of $150,000. And staff showed even further discretion by reducing the penalty, this recommended penalty, to $50,000 for this group of violations. To represent the construction dewatering category of violations, I've selected some evidence from August 31st, 2006 that supports violation IDs 28 and 29 and 30. The evidence includes two photographs and a table from the URS report. This photograph shows the Eel River in the middle, isolated pool B on the bottom, and a discharge of construction dewatering into isolated pool B. As Mona described earlier, the discharge into this location was expressly prohibited in the water quality certification. Caltrans and its contractor should have applied for coverage under the general construction dewatering permit if they wanted to discharge to this location, but they never did. Had they done so, staff would have required stringent water quality protections in the form of BMPs. This photo shows the same event from another perspective. And that was the photo from this excerpt from the biological monitoring report, which describes water pumped into isolated pool B for cofferdam dewatering. This is table 5, an excerpt from the URS report. And the highlighted excerpt describes the discharge and an associated increase in turbidity. All of the evidence that we've just reviewed proves to us the violation of Condition 9, which prohibited the discharge, of also a violation of Condition 12, which required a separate permit for this type of work, and of Condition 17, because the activity is inconsistent with the application to the water quality certification, and because no BMPs were used. After determining the violations, we reviewed the 13385 factors. There was a discharge directly to waters of the state, no communication with the water board staff, discharge without a permit, sediment discharge to a sediment-impaired water body, no BMPs were used, and significant economic benefit by not employing BMPs. There were a total of 39 days of construction dewatering violations in the complaint for a maximum potential penalty and a recommended penalty of $390,000. So I've just finished with a summary, an overview. I didn't cover every single category in the complaint for the 401 due to time restrictions, and there's no way I could cover all of the violations, but that's an overview of our assessment of of compliance with the 401 permit. And now I'll move on to the stormwater permit violations. Section H of the stormwater permit requires Caltrans to implement structural and non-structural BMPs through a construction management program throughout all parts of the state year-round. Many of the violations of the water quality certification would have also been violations of the stormwater permit because of the overlapping requirements to implement BMPs. However, staff is only assessing violations of the stormwater permit for insufficient containment on the trestle deck, which was not specifically covered by our enforcement of the water quality certification, and for improper fueling BMPs, which staff did not address through enforcement of the water quality certification. Staff assesses 130 days of continuous violation for inadequate containment of the trestle deck, based on various pieces of photographic evidence from August 2006 through January 8, 2007, when Water Board staff observed the contractor in the process of installing filter fabric across the trestle deck as the last and final BMP. There is no evidence in the record that at any time prior to January 8th, sufficient BMPs were ever in place to comply with the trestle containment requirements of the stormwater permit. There were also 10 days assessed for insufficient fueling BMPs in presumably an upland location referred to as the TCE on August 9th through 22nd, 2006, and 1 day of insufficient fueling BMPs on the gravel bar on August 22nd, 2006. Here is BMP NS-13 material and equipment use over water from the Caltrans BMP manual required for compliance of the stormwater permit. This BMP applies where materials and equipment are used on barges, boats, docks, and other platforms over or adjacent to a watercourse. This applies to the trestle deck. The purpose is to ensure implementation of procedures that minimize or eliminate discharge of potential pollutants to a watercourse. To do this, the BMP requires Caltrans and its contractor to provide watertight curbs and tow boards to contain spills and prevent materials, tools, and debris from leaving the barge, platform, dock, etc. It also requires them to secure all materials to prevent discharges to receiving waters via wind. Here is BMP NS-9, Vehicle and Equipment Fueling, which requires fueling to be performed in designated areas. It requires regular inspections of fueling areas. It requires that fueling areas shall not be left unattended, to protect fueling areas with berms and or dikes, to clean up materials, and cleanup materials shall be available. Drip pans and absorbent pads shall be used during fueling, etc. This is a piece of evidence. It's an email from the Caltrans Construction Stormwater Coordinator to the resident engineer on this project, amongst other Caltrans employees. The first deficiency observed by the coordinator was equipment is being fueled on the river bar at the North Bridge. Our permit with the Regional Water Quality Control Board explicitly states that fueling must only occur outside of waters of the United States. At the PDT, James Hamm acknowledged that they were fueling a compressor, a generator, manlift, and backhoe. The fifth deficiency in this email says that fueling is occurring in the TCE near the resident engineer's office without use of any BMPs. LAD personnel were fueling a tracked hoe and claimed they had no training of knowledge of required fueling practices and have been fueling their equipment for weeks in such a manner. This is a photograph from August 29, 2006, showing the trestle deck, and it shows inadequate containment along the perimeter here. Here's some photos from August 30th, 2006. Also shows no perimeter containment, such as tow boards, no filter fabric, no barrier along the railing. And here, looking up underneath as you can see light passing through the trestle deck, clearly not a watertight seal. This photograph shows a rusty I-beam with lots of debris strewn about on the trestle without sufficient containment along the edges to prevent the debris from falling off the trestle as required by the BMP. This photograph goes further to show a lack of tow boards along the edge of the trestle, a lack of containment along the railing to prevent debris from falling onto the gravel bar or into the river. This photograph also depicts a lack of containment for potential leaks from the compressor in the middle of the photograph. This photograph shows holes in the trestle deck and gaps between the beams where debris could fall directly into the river below. As you can see here, it's difficult to see perhaps with the lighting here, but looking through, you see a footing in the river directly below. This excerpt from the Biological Monitoring Report describes the inadequate attempt at sealing the trestle with caulking and the effect of that equipment on the deck caused it to flex and separate the seal. It also describes constant leaks from equipment onto the decking and the potential for rocks and other debris to fall through the holes in the deck. This photo was titled Flexed Trestle Decking by the Biological Monitor. The weight and movement of equipment on the trestle would cause it to flex, causing gaps in the boards, showing that a watertight seal was not achieved as required by the BMP. This photograph goes further to depict holes in the trestle, a lack of containment along the sides where sawdust and other materials, including tools, could discharge to the river. Here along the sides, no tow boards, no railing, here's a hole, here's materials that could fall. This photograph shows the rusty I-beams used to support the trestle, and a lack of containment to prevent the rusty debris from falling directly to the river and gravel bar below. This photograph shows various items of debris left uncontained on the trestle deck with insufficient containment along the sides over here to prevent the discharges of this material. This excerpt from Biological Monitoring Report describes the general state of debris on the trestle deck, the potential for rust debris to discharge to the river, and inadequate containment at sealing the trestle with caulking or expanding foam. This photograph and caption was taken from the Biological Monitor and expresses the potential for debris to discharge to the river due to a lack of containment. Potential for debris being knocked into the river due to lack of non-continuous and non-solid railing and tow boards that stop. This excerpt from a Biological Monitoring Report says, however, the old deck mats employed directly above the river are not as flat or well sealed and have the potential to allow debris to enter into the river. Violations of the stormwater permit were assessed for 130 days of continuous insufficient containment of the trestle deck, 10 days of insufficient fueling BMPs at the TCE, and 1 day of insufficient fueling BMPs on the gravel bar. The maximum potential penalty for these violations was $1.41 million, and in the complaint, and staff recommends a penalty for these 141 days of violation of $450,000. This slide summarizes the water quality certification, or the 401, the different categories, the stormwater permit, trestle containment, upland, fueling, and this is incorrect here, but it should be fueling on the gravel bar. The 130.10.1 we just discussed, the number of violations in the complaint, and then in rebuttal and all the legal exchanges we've had in the past few months, there's been a few concessions made by the water board outlined here. The remaining violations indicated in the chart A2. Here's the maximum potential penalty identified in the complaint, the proposed penalty in the complaint, and the remaining proposed penalty based on our most recent communication with the board in chart A2. This, I will point out that these total recommended penalties do not include staff costs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Does that conclude your testimony?
It concludes our case in chief, and they now stand ready for cross-examination.
Great, thank you. The board's going to take a five-minute break for necessary reasons. Thank you. I believe everybody's back. Are we ready to continue? Okay, great. Thank you. Let's